The following podcast contains coarse language, adult themes, and major plot spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
And welcome back to episode 2 of Podcasters of Horror. This is our mini-series podcast, and at the moment we will be talking about Masters of Horror, which was the anthology TV show created by Mick Garris that aired from 2004 to 2005?
About 2005-2006.
Probably 2006. Of course, I am your host, Super Marcy, and I'm joined with my co-host, the terrible Aussie Bead.
Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Oh, not too bad, thanks. What's been going on?
Lots of busy things happening in life, so haven't had much of a chance to do a lot of the awesome things that we want to do. So life has been busy.
Yeah, it has been for me as well, and I'm looking forward to finally getting back into recording Podcasters of Horror, and as well as our upcoming podcasts for our other shows as well. And
yes,
but we definitely have a lot to talk about with this latest episode of the show.
That we do. And for anyone listening who may not have seen Masters of Horror or hasn't seen it for a while, this will of course have spoilers for the episode. So if you don't want to know, watch the episodes, then listen. Yep. Or this could be, if you haven't seen it for a while, it's a bit of a refresher. But we were discussing, once we finish Masters of Horror, we'll continue our Podcasters of Horror series with Fear Itself.
Yeah.
And possibly some other interesting anthology-type shows, so you can keep your eyes and ears peeled for those. So with episode 2 of Podcasters of Horror, we are up to episodes 3 and 4 of Masters of Horror. So we will dive straight into episode 3, or short movie 3, which is called Dance of the Dead.
A ring around the rosy, a pocket full of hope.
What's wrong with the sky?
It's bliss! Everybody take cover!
Death toll in the U.S. alone from months of terrorist blitz attacks is now officially over 9 million, and 7 American cities, including New York and Los Angeles, remain destroyed by the war.
We're safe! We're safe!
Please, 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 please!
Don't you want to see the world?
My mother says that there isn't much left of the world.
Plenty left if you know where to go.
Everything people in Mesquite do is a goddamn trick. I'm not losing another daughter.
Mommy let you out?
What is it?
It's what's inside your head, Angel.
Ladies and gentlemen,
I give you the Dance of the Dead. Oh, you just can't get enough, can you?
How long was I out?
A few minutes. You go somewhere good?
Directed by Toby Hooper. Short story by Richard Matheson. Teleplay by Richard Christian Matheson. And the synopsis for this one is: a teenage girl living in a post-apocalyptic village befriends a group of rough punks who hang out at a sinister bar where reanimated corpses dance on stage. So, interesting fact about this episode, Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins scored the episode, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And I actually forgotten he actually did score this episode until I rewatched it.
Yeah,
recently.
Same here. I can't remember if I actually did see this or not originally.
Mm.
So watching it again, it was definitely interesting, especially being a fan of the late Toby Hooper. It's yep. definitely interesting to see some other little things he has done. And this, Dance of the Dead stars Jonathan Tucker, Emily Graham, Robert Englund of all people, Marilyn Norris, Dylan McDonald, Erica Carroll, Lucy Guest, Jessica Lowndes, and Melina Ramos.
Mm.
So quite a few people in this one. So yeah, getting straight into this one, there's no real easy way to kind of describe this episode.
Yeah, it's kind of like I kind of should say, like, before we go into it, like, this is one will be an interesting, this whole episode is interesting to me because the two films that we're discussing, I had very different opinions on them then than I do now. Mm. Because I remember with Dance of the Dead, it was when it first came out and I watched it, I actually hated it the first time I watched it.
I can understand that, to be honest.
Yeah, but now having rewatched it now, like 14 years later, I definitely enjoyed it a lot more, which is kind of interesting. But I feel like at the time I kind of probably just, I guess it's more to do with the filmmaking style that Toby Hooper brought to this episode.
Yeah.
But also the content, like the story and everything. But it's interesting rewatching it now because, if anything, like what Toby Hooper does with from a filmmaking level, actually, it makes the episode interesting. Like,
yeah.
Like you said, it doesn't really work for everyone. But I feel like at the same time, it kind of just, it adds to sort of the, I guess, the punk rock feel of the whole episode.
Because there's that whole sort of post-apocalyptic punk thing going on. Like, the way it's kind of shot and edited, as you mentioned to me, it's kind of like that Tony Scott of the 2000s kind
yeah,
of
like,
crazy. But even sort of a little bit of Saw had that as well.
Yeah.
But what I think, like, it doesn't always work for me, and it makes you feel like you need to be on drugs to watch it. Because it can actually be a little bit disorientating. But it does kind of fit the theme with how it's set in this post-apocalyptic world. There's kind of, I guess, drugs are kind of responsible for a lot of things. But it does add some interesting points about what life would be like in a post-apocalyptic kind of world, whereas things in some parts are still like business as usual, whereas the main character of Peggy works in like a diner with her mum. But then sort of on the other side of town, you have this crazy bar where anything goes. And there are points where you see like the two punk guys that she meets later stop an old couple and steal one of them's blood. And you're like, what the hell's going on? But then that kind of ties into what happens at the actual club. So with this, it's called Dance of the Dead because they go watch, I guess, reanimated corpses dance.
Yeah, well,
in a weird way.
Yeah, well, it does explain how that's possible because I believe from what I remember during, because it's sort of like set, I guess, after World War III.
Mm.
And something sort of happened during the battle and reanimated corpses were able to get up, but they weren't in sort of, I guess, zombie mode or anything like that. They were more like they just got up and they would just move around and start doing this odd looking dance. And so they these clubs, like the club in particular run by Robert Englund, kind of uses them as entertainment. And
yeah,
in an interesting way, it's sort of like, it is kind of a different take on the zombie genre.
It is a quite different because it's not something we've really seen before.
Mm.
So, from what I understand, just reading back on the plot, so it says, in 2008, terrorists developed a biological weapon called Blizz. They use this weapon in local weather patterns in the United States. As it falls from the sky, it will instantly burn any living thing it touches. So, when Peggy, the main character, is young, she watches as that happens at her birthday party. So, they go inside and don't get hit by it. but she sees, like, the neighbours and stuff getting affected by this. So then the movie takes place 10 years later. So, it's as you said, it's after World War III. So you obviously see the effects of that blizz, because you see people severely burned and stuff
who
don't really act as normal.
Yeah, there's at one point at the early part of the episode, one of the neighbours who was at Peggy's birthday party actually comes to the restaurant where Peggy and her mum work at and wants food, and she gets turned away, but Peggy brings her a sandwich and that, and you kind of see how what the Blitz has done to her. She's all scarred up and deformed by what happened to her. And it's interesting sort of seeing that, you know, you got this, these characters like Peggy and her mum trying to get back to normal with life, but yet there's all this kind of desolation that's going on around them. And either people kind of, like I said, either sort of try to move on with their lives almost as if nothing happened. Yeah. Or then you got Jonathan Tucker and his gang kind of like just, as all people seem to do in a post-apocalyptic movies, just go completely insane and just doing whatever they want and making a profit out of doing whatever jobs they can get their hands on.
Yeah, pretty much. And it seems that they obviously get blood for money for the Doom Room, which is the sort of heavy metal bar. So when they actually go in there and you see like the performance, the Dance of the Dead, they inject them with, I guess it's the blood, but
mixed in with something else,
which makes the dead sort of, you know, looks like they're convulsing and having seizures, but they call it the Dance of the Dead sort of thing.
Yeah.
And just reading up, it says apparently during the war, they used it on the dead soldiers so they could keep fighting. So it's obviously being misused as a form of entertainment.
Yeah. Now that the World War III is over. Yeah. And I gotta say, like, this club is really interesting. Again, it's like has every kind of that kind of post-apocalyptic cliche you can think of, with everyone just, you got people who have either lost limbs or just people just, you know, just so much debauchery going on in this club.
Yeah.
And having Robert Englund as the MC is awesome, because you could tell he's having an absolute ball playing this character. It's a very creepy performance and almost kind of disgusting as well, but you could tell he's just relishing playing this role.
He is. And there's a moment where he's with like two zombie women
and they're
doing stuff to him, or
doing stuff to him.
So it's a bit iffy as well, but if there's a point this movie's trying to say, I think it's that, obviously beware of biological chemical weapons. Yeah,
exactly.
And don't have a post-apocalyptic world, because shit happens.
Yeah. But it's interesting kind of, because Jessica Lauders, who plays the lead role of Peggy, I think she was about 16, 17 at the time when this episode was shot, so it's interesting kind of seeing, like, her character progress through the film. I thought she did a really solid job with her performance, but it's interesting because when we get through the episode, she's been led to believe that by her mum, that her older sister has went pretty much, you know, to the Doom Room and just gone off and ran away and stuff. But then we find out in a bit of a plot twist that while she was at the Doom Room, she had OD'd. And as when Peggy's mum went to go fetch her, she realizes she's dead, but sort of realized, because you kind of get a sense that with Peggy's mum, there was a bit of a hostility between her and her sister. But then you find out that she, when her sister was dying, her mother sold her off to the MC to become one of the zombies in the Dance of the Dead.
Yeah, so she wasn't actually dead and she was sold off. So this revelation of sorts sends Peggy a little bit loopy, and her mum pretty much gets beaten to death.
Yeah.
And she, I guess she sells her to be a zombie dancer.
Yeah, that's what happens at the end, and Peggy becomes one of the punks as well by the end of it.
Yeah, so it's kind of this weird vicious cycle of, I guess, things. But it sort of has interesting revelations. As far as, like, if there's any metaphors or anything, I don't know. Like I said, I think it's more about the dangers of what could happen.
Yeah.
If you sort of let wars and all sorts of things kind of take over.
Yeah.
And I think it makes you lose sight of your own humanity.
Mm. Also, it could be...
Which I think happens in this movie.
Yeah,
as well.
Also it could be, like, oppression as well, because Peggy's mum doesn't want her to go outside of, like, the world that they've created and all that. And because she... From Peggy's mum's point of view, because she saw what happened to her oldest daughter and doesn't want that happen to Peggy, but Peggy sort of realises that, you know, that by doing this, it's just caused more problems than it is. But there are, like, other things about the short I find really just... Like I said, I think even though, it can be very kinetic and disorienting the way it's shot and edited, but visually the episode does look great.
It does.
And it does feel, I guess... compared to some of the other episodes of Masters, which we'll be talking about over the next few episodes, that it does have that more sort of cinematic feel.
Yeah, it does. Like, you could easily see this being expanded as a feature-length movie, because there is a lot to it. But it is really well shot. It's decently acted.
Yeah. I mean, some of the performances are kind of on and off. I think some of the gang members in Jonathan Tucker's crew are kind of all over the place with their performance. At least, and even Jonathan Tucker does come off a little wooden at times.
Yeah, at least he kind of... I think his character's kind of meant to be like that.
Yeah.
In a way. But there's also this the sort of romantic element between Jonathan Tucker's character and Peggy.
Yeah.
Whereas there's just... They're instantly drawn to each other.
Yeah.
And he seems to want to protect her at all costs, even though he's known her, like, for 2 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was kind of an interesting thing. But I guess if you're living in this kind of environment, you kind of take what you can get, in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but I didn't notice this at the time when I watched the episode until this recent watch. Did you notice all the kind of references to Clockwork Orange throughout the film?
I don't think I did.
Well, you know, like, Peggy...
But I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, like Peggy and, you know, the gang when they drive into the club, the way how that shot, it kind of looks how...
Yeah, actually, you're right.
That, you know, having, like, you know, in Clockwork Orange, Alex and his friends are driving around and it has that sort of background, like, things are flying by and it's still... But interesting enough, the bodyguards at the Doom Room, what the clothes they wear kind of looks similar to Alex and his friends were wearing in the first half of Clockwork Orange as well. So I don't know.
Outfits.
Yeah, like I don't know if it was intentional or not, but I just sort of picked up on those references to
Pick that up. So yeah. Very interesting. So what would you rate this out of 5?
I'd say it's about a 3 out of 5. Like, I think there's a lot of interesting things in it, but there are things, again, that do figure flawed. Like I said, some of the performances are a bit all over the place. Some of the filmmaking, while really interesting, can be a little much at times. Although Toby Hooper does use that style again for his season 2 episode of Masters of Horror, the Dan thing, but he tones it down a little bit more in that one. But I feel like at the same time, though, it does work. Having it be a little too much kind of works for and against the episode. But overall, I think it's a really solid episode, and one I've definitely appreciated a lot more since the first time.
I think I probably liked it a little bit more than you, just in terms of, you know, different aspects. For me, I think the weakest parts was some of the acting, like, it's just really overdone. But I think Robert Englund just does such a great job.
He's phenomenal in this.
He's one of the definitely more interesting characters in the movie. So I'd probably give it 3.5 out of 5.
Yeah. I mean, my rating could probably go up the next time I watched it. But yeah, I mean, the fact is, the first time I watched it, I think I gave it like 1.5. So the thing it's gone up a couple of stars compared to 3 is definitely something. So it might go up a bit more on this.
Yeah, and that's something I've noticed with the work of Toby Hooper. For example, when I first saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I think it'd been just overhyped in general. Yeah. So when I watched it, I thought it was absolute crap and I hated it. And then upon so many rewatches, it's now one of my favourite movies. So I think that's kind of the effect where Toby Hooper, you kind of need to rewatch his stuff.
Yeah,
And I could say the same with Life Force. I think watching it again recently, which you can check out our discussion on the Horror Returns podcast. I definitely enjoyed it a lot more on repeated viewing. So I think that's kind of the magic of Tobe Hooper.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, yeah. So that is episode 3, Dance of the Dead. Now we'll move on to episode 4.
Yes.
I'll get beat to.
Indeed. We're going on to episode 4, which, of course, is Dario Argento's Jennifer.
Freeze! Police! Throw down your weapon!
It's too late! Go away! You don't know what she is!
Don't do it!
Jennifer!
You kill a psychopath. I don't care that he was trying to slice her up. It's gotta warp you.
What's wrong with her face? What happened to her?
Do you know where she's from?
Apparently, she didn't really have a home. I can tell you her name is Jennifer.
So where's she now?
She's at Watkins Island. Poor thing, I don't even know how much she understands.
Jennifer, what are you doing here?
She's got nobody to care about her. She's got no place to go.
Hello?
I'm gonna find her a place to stay.
She can't
don't
stay
worry.
Here.
That's right.
Who would take her?
Can you blame them, Frank? Look at her.
It's just one more night. That's it.
What did you do?
Jennifer.
Hi, what's your name?
Which, of course, is directed by Dario Argento, the director behind Suspiria, Inferno, and Deep Red. And the episode stars Stephen Weber and Carrie-Anne Fleming. And Stephen Weber actually also wrote the episode, which is based on a short comic book written by Bruce Jones. And the plot summary for this one is as follows. A police officer saves the life of a hideously deformed young woman, only to find himself drawn into a web of murder and self-destruction from which he finds hard to break away. Now, we have a lot to talk about this one, but I'll say this, though. Like, you know, like how I said with Dance of the Dead, that was an episode. The first time I watched it, I hated it, but now, rewatching it lately, I liked it.
Mm.
Jennifer is the complete opposite. When I watched Jennifer the first time, I thought, oh, this is okay. Memorable, but okay. But now having rewatched it again recently, I can safely admit that this is definitely a bad episode. But at the same time, it's a memorable one.
It's interesting. Look, to start off with, the character of Jennifer is probably the perfect definition of what one might call a butterface.
Yeah.
She's got a very, like, messed up face, but this, like, hot body. And it seems like any man she kind of connects with goes down this massive downward spiral where they end up wanting to kill her because she's uncontrollable.
And also, like, she has sex with whoever her partners are. Yeah. But at the same time, she also has cannibalistic tendencies as well. So she, which is, this sort of definitely adds to that. But yeah, kind of rewatching this episode, I think at the time I watched Jennifer, I think I only seen 2 Dario Argento films prior, which were Phenomena and I believe Suspiria. So when I watched this one, like the first time I watched it, I just felt, oh, visually it's pretty muted compared to his other work. But now having seen a lot of his, you know, other work since then, and particularly his recent work, this Jennifer definitely falls along the lines of his most recent work. But I can understand that this is an episode that doesn't really necessarily need to be visually flashy, even though there are some kind of weird and odd camera angles in this one, particularly in the opening scene where Stephen Weber's character and who plays a cop and his partner are just having lunch in their car. The way how that section is shot is like weird because all the camera angles are just bizarre.
It is really weird. And sorry, just reading. So Jennifer is adapted from a 10-page black and white comic book story written by Bruce Jones and illustrated by Bernie Wrightson that originally appeared in issue number 63, July 1974 of the horror anthology title Creepy. So I'm actually kind of curious to
I've actually seen
see it now.
I've seen panels of the original comic book, and let's just say that the Jennifer in the original comic is actually even more grotesque than is in the episode. But interesting enough, though, because I remember when the episode came out on DVD and I watched it, and I was going through the special features of Jennifer, there's actually a lot of... They had a feature on the short graphic novel, and they actually... Dario Argento actually took panels from that and recreated them for the episode. You know the bit where... Stephen Webb is asleep, and then Jennifer comes in through the door, and it's all white in the background. That's directly from the comic. But there are little moments like that. Like, there's a dream sequence where you see Jennifer, I get, you know, the real Carrie Ann Fleming's face, like, in this kind of dream sequence, and how that shot almost kind of feels resentment of Dario's kind of giallo work. But then it kind of goes back to that muted section. But I think the thing about this episode, like, re-watching it again, is just... You know how we talked about with, on the last episode, Dreams of the Witch House? Like, even though that movie was played very straight and was very creepy, but you kind of got a sense that Stuart Gordon added a bit of camp to it, or at least delivery. I kept wondering throughout this recent rewatch, because this, watching it, I didn't realize how even more campy this episode is, and I just kept thinking whether that was totally deliberate, or whether it was like, unintentionally made that way.
Yeah, and when you're watching this, you're kind of going, what the fuck are you doing, dude? It's like, why are you obsessed with this woman doing all these things when obviously it's wrong? And, you know, she's some kind of...
A kind of a succubus type.
Yeah, she's like some kind of, you know, demon thing or something. Yeah. Like, there's something not right with her. She wants to cannibalize everything. Like, why are you drawn to her? Is it just because she has a nice pair of tits, mate?
I think that's what it is. I mean, don't want to objectify Carrie Ann Fleming, but her, when you kind of, you know, in the nude scenes and that, her body is pretty spectacular. Let's just admit.
Well, there's nothing wrong with her body.
Yeah.
But she's quite, you know, without the makeup on, she is a very beautiful woman.
Yeah.
But you're kind of wondering, like, is this meant to be a metaphor for something? Like, is Jennifer meant to represent, like, a man's addiction to something?
Yeah, I kept thinking that too, because the way sort of, like, how Stephen Webber's character has his relationship with Jennifer is formed throughout the movie, and they're in the self-destruction, the self-destructive nature that their relationship goes down, you kind of, and you see how it's sort of taking a toll on him. He's like, sometimes he'll be out drinking a lot, or... And he just looks run down and ragged. And I guess it could be like Jennifer could be sort of a metaphor for some kind of addiction.
Look, I think Jennifer could represent someone's inner demons manifesting themselves to give you that self-destructive behavior. Whereas, you know, some people will deal with demons really well in their life. Some people will turn to drugs or alcohol or something to deal with it. So I think, you know, the more I thought about it, it's like, is this something where it's like, metaphorically, she is, you know, someone's inner demons, and they're taking over to the point where it's really self-destructive and obsessive with what you're doing.
Yeah, like having a sort of, you know, having this, you know, great body and sort of this ugly face, it's almost like, you know, like if you were taking, say, the drug metaphor, like it has that appeal to it, but then you have this ugliness to it as well, and could be that, or maybe we're just looking way too much into it.
We could be looking way too much into it, but I like to think there's a little bit more substance to this movie. I didn't think the performances were that great.
And Stephen Webb is actually a pretty solid actor, and I just felt
he didn't really deliver his normal stuff. And it's funny, considering he wrote the teleplay for it. Like, you would have thought maybe he would have done a bit better, because he's usually very solid. So it's... I think, sorry, I forgot her name, who plays Jennifer.
Carrie Ann Fleming.
I think she's probably the one who actually delivers the best performance.
Yeah, I agree. Like,
even though she doesn't really talk or anything, I think it's just done with her movements and just how she expresses herself through everything else, other than talking or... you know, facial expressions.
Yeah, because when we kind of see Jenna for the first time, she's like this, almost like this wounded animal. Mm. Like, she's like frightened and scared. Mm. And then the way how she can play that sort of innocence and then switch it around to be absolutely evil is really well done. And you can definitely see, like, in a way, why Stephen Weber's character, Frank, that's the name I'm looking up now, Frank, the character of Frank, like, is a becomes instantly infatuated with her. And also, my favourite scene in the movie, like, I think anytime Carrie Ann Fleming is on screen, that's when the film delivers, but I really like the scene with, when she meets the little girl next door to Frank's house. That whole scene, like, that just really was really creepy. And it reminded me of the scene in the original 1931 Frankenstein film when Frankenstein meets the little girl.
Yeah.
Although, except when Frankenstein killed the little girl, it was he didn't realize he was doing it wrong. Yeah. But she clearly was like, I'm going to eat you, bitch.
Yeah, pretty much.
And there is some pretty gruesome gore in it.
There
as
is.
Well.
There is. There's nudity. There's gore. Mm. There's a really ugly weird face in it. It's just really disturbing. Like, I'm sorry, I don't want to look at it.
Actually, it's they even had to cut it down a little bit because I remember seeing the behind the scenes video. And you know, like, because in the scene later in the movie when Frank basically he takes Jennifer, they go off to this little cabin in the woods somewhere, and Frank decides to get a job, and he meets this single mum played by Mick Garris's real life wife Cynthia Garris and her son. Can't remember the actor's name, so forgive me. So basically, the son has a run-in with Jennifer because he is kind of having girlfriend struggles. So he kind of he too becomes infatuated with Jennifer, and then of course Frank stumbles upon them in being eaten by Jennifer. But in the behind the scenes, that was actually gruesome because you actually got to see Jennifer actually bite his dick off.
Oh,
but it's well more implied here.
Yeah.
So that stuff is really creepy, and I did like the fact that how it ends. Basically, Frank decides he's going to kill Jennifer, but then he gets stopped and killed by a hunter.
So, again, like, as we said with Dance of the Dead, it's like this cycle that keeps going to keep going. This is a cycle that keeps going, I think, because with Dance of the Dead, they're obviously getting, you know, while Peggy was free of her mum, she's still continuing this cycle of joining the gang and wallowing in that entertainment, which is what her mum tried to stop. Whereas in here, it's like the cycle of this woman, you know, the man tries to kill her, someone sees it, not knowing what she is, kills the man, and then she's obviously gonna destroy the next man's life. So
I just had a thought, and here's another theory I might have, because we've been going with, say, the addiction fear and that. Could it also be, like, symbolic for trauma as well? Because at the beginning,
possible.
Yeah, because Frank kills the guy who Jennifer's previous partner, but then, you know, the police are like, you need to go talk about this. I mean, it's not it's troubling to shoot someone even on the job, and Frank just keeps shoving it off. So could it also be,
it could be a manifestation of trauma, of grief. Again, we could be reading way too much into it.
Probably way more than this episode probably deserves. But now sort of talking about it makes me at least appreciative of the episode a little bit more, because
there could be things in it. But yeah, it's definitely not one of my favourites. What's your rating?
I give this one about, now sort of talking about it now, I'll probably give it about a 2 out of 5.
That would be my score, would be 2 out of 5. I think mostly just for how Jennifer's played, or how she plays it, and the possible metaphors that we've discussed, if they're real. But yeah, it's a very weird one. Not something I'm keen to watch anytime soon again.
Yeah, actually, I want to give sort of a shout out, because I forgot to mention this, the score in the film was really nicely done too, and it does remind me of, like, Dario's previous work as well, especially the beginning. It's sort of that creepy kind of lullaby kind of sound. So yeah, but I can actually see, I think this kind of episode works as a 1 hour episode, but I think I would mind seeing another interpretation, because I think sort of talking about what we're doing now, if someone came along and took sort of what we were talking about, what this story could mean on a thematic level, and add a lot more to it, it could be expanded into something more interesting.
It could be. I just think maybe it wasn't handled in the best way. So that wraps up episode 2 of Podcasters of Horror. So you can check us out on the Super Network. You can go to www.supermarcy.com for all the goodness. We are on iTunes, we are on Stitcher, so you can search for either Super Marcy or the Super Network or the Super Podcast.
Yep.
You'll find us and you can subscribe. You can also follow me on Twitter at Super Marcy and our Super Network on Twitter, which, forgive me, I always forget what it is, which is really bad.
Twitter.com/SM_Super Network, I believe.
It is SM_Super Network.
Yep, that's it. I got it right.
And you can send us an email at thesupernetworksm@gmail.com. You can find our Facebook page at The Super Network on Facebook, or you can look up The Super Network group and you can join in our Facebook group with lots of fun discussions and meme sharing and trailers and all that. And Beach, any last shout outs for you?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/BeachMine. And of course, you can follow all my writings, columns, and reviews over at supermarcy.com, and as well as check out my column Horror Down Under over at The Screencast. I'm working on a brand new one at the moment, so keep a lookout for that. And also look out for my upcoming Myth 2019 audio reviews. I'll be doing, try to do those daily, so keep out, look out for those. And for those who are sort of, I always keep forgetting to mention this, when we, if you're listening through the show through iTunes, definitely leave a review or whether it's, or a star rating on there, and that way it gives that our little podcast, like our multiple podcasts on this network, a bit, you know, gets a bit more love. So do that, and that'd be really,
and make sure they're 5-star ratings, because, you know, you love us.
Yes.
Until next time, I've been Marcy, and I've been Super.
Yep. This is Bede, the Terrible Australian, and we'll see you all later, guys.
Bye.
Bye.